Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the State House dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of December 31st, 2019. We are fresh off our 2019 year in review, and you're thinking, Gavin, nothing can be more comprehensive than a year in review. Wrong. You're wrong. We have, AT, help me. The decade in review. Let it ring. 10 years. It's so big, this decade. It's so big. It's so huge. It's so massive. It's so tremendous that we had to have two episodes. Two. And this is the first one, guys. So make sure you stick tuned to the second one, which is also being released. But to recap the whole decade, I brought in some heavy hitters to do this. We have Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press and Andy Shane, the Columbia Bureau Chief for the Post and Courier. This is such a big podcast. We're taping this in advance too for the holiday season, that we don't have any other sections besides just the discussion. Don't get used to it, but it's just the discussion. And you can listen to all one section of this podcast instead of staying away from people because you got that cold coming on. You can probably hear my voice, right? You guys know my octaves. Or while you have high hopes for your New Year's resolution, we're all pulling for you. Did you get that Peloton you wanted for Christmas? Now, without any further ado, the decade in review. Our 231-year-old state is about to go through its 20s for the third time. But before we get to the 2020s, I figured we'd take a look back at the important things of the past 10 years that have gotten us to where we are today. To do that, I have Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press and Andy Shane, Columbia Bureau Chief for the Post and Courier in studio. Hey guys, how are ya?
Doing fine, Gavin. It's a great day in South Carolina to be doing a 2010 review.
Already getting a jump on me. Andy, how are you doing, man?
I was to say, I don't know if I have a catchphrase, but it's good to be here.
Great. Over the past few days, I reviewed a lot of year-in-review lists from the past 10 years. Thank you, Richland Library, for having access to Newsbank. So I checked out lists from the state newspaper, the Post and Courier, and the AP to make kind of a master list of the past 10 years. And instead of going year by year, I distilled the news into themes such as the governor's office, corruption, Congress, business, weather, and race relations. And there's also a list of other events that happened in the past 10 years at the end. So kind of want to start this off with Andy Shane talking about what we've seen in the governor's office for the past 10 years. You know, Mark Sanford going out in disgrace, the election of Nikki Haley in 2010, the Haley decade, and now McMaster's in office. Andy, kind of give me an overview of what happened and how important it was and kind of how things were back in the early days of the 2010s and what we saw happen this past decade.
You know, it's been a remarkable decade in the governor's mansion, to say the least. I mean, Nikki Haley was elected by a big surprise. I mean, it's the Nikki Haley we know today, who's very popular, who's very much a national figure. In 2010, she was a six-year state lawmaker, a backbencher. She had managed to pass one bill she had sponsored during her time in office. She was really not seen as the favorite in her own primary. She was running against a congressman. She was running against a sitting lieutenant governor. She was running against a sitting attorney general who had also been a U.S. attorney. And sure enough, she came out ahead in the primary. It was the year of the Tea Party. She ran as a Tea Party candidate. She was able to, you know, coalesce a lot of support. She was able to get the backing of Sarah Palin, who was, still very popular at that time, coming off the 2008 election. And she managed to pull off really a huge upset in the Republican primary over these three veteran politicians. And she, you know, was able to overcome even some obstacles in the general election, where in a very generally Republican state, she still had a bit of a battle against Democrat Vincent Shaheen because she was an unknown. People didn't know what to expect. They knew what to expect with the other three candidates. They had been in office a while, but Nikki Haley was very much a wild card.
And then she was kind of similar in some respects. She grew into that role over her 1.5 terms, essentially, in terms of using that bully pulpit, too. She was similar to Mark Sanford in ways of pushing the legislature, and we'll talk about Governor McMaster in a minute, but she was also the jobs governor. She was also the governor that told her cabinet agencies she wants callers to be greeted with the phrase, "It's a great day in South Carolina." Mm-hmm. And then she also oversaw Mother Emanuel, the tragedy, and also numerous other natural disasters hit the state. So, but when we look at that span, Andy, how did it work out for Nikki Haley in terms of how she left the office or...
Sure. She, you know, she came in. She was the first woman and the first minority to serve as governor of South Carolina. She was seen as the new face of the National Republican Party. So that gave her a lot of leverage to be able to use, as you said, that bully pulpit to get what she wanted, to get the tax cuts she wanted, to get the Department of Administration that she wanted. She won election handed, you know, very handedly. She was the jobs governor. She was very proud of how she brought in, thousands of jobs and economic development. She would give CEOs her phone number. She used her job, which doesn't have a lot of power, but has a huge microphone, I think, to the maximum. And then a Mother Emanuel happened, the Emanuel AME shooting, and she really took another turn. She used that as a mechanism to take down the Confederate flag from the State House, which had been at the State House at that point for five decades. It was not easy, but it did happen. And again, she was willing to put her political capital out there, to put herself out there on that. And so when she left office to become the UN ambassador under Donald Trump, she was able to leave, I think, with a lot of accomplishments, the economic development accomplishments, what she was able to do with the Confederate flag, and what she was able to do with the office, as you said, carrying on what Mark Sanford did and really making it a bully pulpit to get some of the things that she wanted done.
Mm-hmm. And also the DOR Department. Department of Revenue data breach also happened under her tenure. 3.8 million citizens of South Carolina had their information hacked from the Department of Revenue. Obviously, that one of her cabinet agencies, but one of the bigger issues that happened under her tenure.
Exactly. And that was the worst hacking of a state agency ever in a country. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you had millions and millions of taxpayers whose information had been exposed. We still don't know quite what happened, how it got hacked. They consider it still part of an investigation 7 years later. But, again, she had to handle that, and she ended up replacing the agency head as a result of that.
And just we're going to transition to Governor McMaster right now, but you know she started off with an $800 million budget shortfall. Jeffrey, now we are in Governor McMaster's first full year of his first full term, and he's getting like a $2 billion budget surplus essentially right now. So we've seen how things have changed in South Carolina economically. But tell us a little bit about how Governor McMaster ascended to the position that he's always wanted to be, and that's governor of South Carolina.
We got to go back all the way to 2010,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, Henry McMaster is running for governor in 2010 against Nikki Haley, Gresham Barrett, and Andre Bauer. And, you know, if we were sitting here exactly 10 years ago, we would be like, well, maybe Henry can squeak his way into the runoff against Gresham Barrett. You know, maybe that'll work out. Well, in, you know, June 2010, Henry got 17% of the vote. Henry McMaster, you know, what, more than 4 in 5 Republican voters rejected Henry McMaster in 2010. A lot of political obits were written about the guy then. I mean, because, you know, you don't come back from that typically. You know, he goes off in the wilderness. He gets a job with the Ports Authority. He raises some money for the University of South Carolina Law School. Season opening, the last time the state's going to elect its lieutenant governor in 2014. Probably needed a job, so runs for it. And maybe he had some calculation. Maybe there's a chance he ascends to the governor's office. Mm-hmm. Well, personally, I think one of the biggest dates in this decade was January 27, 2016, at Harmon's Tree Farm in Gilbert, when Henry McMaster, to most of our surprise, strides on stage and endorses Donald Trump.
Yeah.
The first, you know, a major elected official to,
in the country.
Yeah, in the country to endorse Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time, we were all like, what in the world? But, I mean, it worked out perfectly. I mean, you know, Trump gets elected.
Wins South Carolina by a huge margin. Everyone else is endorsing Rubio or I mean, Ted Cruz came in. Yeah.
Nikki Haley tore into Trump or at least, you know, criticized Trump during the primary when Ian McMaster was kind of out here by himself. Donald Trump gets elected. Nikki Haley gets the UN ambassadorship as a favor to Henry McMaster.
The lieutenant governor at the time,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, all these years suddenly— Henry McMaster is elevated to the governorship, and it's a paradigm shift in South Carolina. We've elected young governors for a long, long time. Henry McMaster is 10 years older than David Beasley, than Jim Hodges right now. I mean, I'm not talking about when he took office. He's 10 years older right now. We never have, you know, it's been a long, long time.
Jeffrey, he was the oldest governor elected, you know, at his age.
Yes, and you know, if he can legally be governor if the voters decide in 2022 until 2026, he would be, let me do the quick math here, that'd be 7 years older than he is now, 79.
Yeah.
He'd be 79 or 78. I don't think he'd have a birthday yet, but yeah. So, I mean,
well, Leatherman is the oldest politician in the state at 88, and he's the most powerful politician.
At the end of February next year, he will be the oldest living governor South Carolina has ever had.
And so Henry McMaster's term has been very interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing is, if you think about it, he was the embodiment of established Republicanism. He was chairman of the Republican Party in the late 90s when the Republicans flipped the General Assembly and finished their ascension into power in South Carolina. But I don't think I'd call him the embodiment of the establishment Republican Party now. I mean, look at his position on abortion. Look at he vetoed the gas tax. I mean, there's things that he does that are pretty conservative, especially if you put him like on a graph compared to other Republican politicians in South Carolina. And he's had a very quiet kind of first couple of years. I mean, he's made some noise. You know, he does his news conferences and things like that. But there's yet to be a real pressure point, to be a real crisis he's had to deal with. Yet to be the Mother Emanuel, the flood of 2015, the ice storm, the stuff that that Governor Haley had to deal with. So looking forward, that'll be the interesting
thing.
He's
had some of those natural disasters recently, like hurricanes, but obviously not major disaster.
We'll get to that. And you know, the good news is most of those curved out to sea. You know, he hadn't had the really big, you know, oh, everything is gone.
And really trying to make himself the education governor, too. I mean, even saying in his inauguration address this year, saying, I want to get rid of the corridor of shame, which is, again, a huge tough sell, but one that they're chipping away with. They got plenty of money to try and fix this problem. But
and look at his 2018 reelection campaign. You know, that again, Trump helped him out with that too. Because I'm not, you know, does he win the Republican primary if he doesn't have the Trump boost? You can make an argument one way or the other. And look at how he ran. He ran as your kind grandfather. The state's doing great. Look, you go out there and fish or cheer for Clemson or South Carolina, whatever you want to do. I'll just make sure things run right and keep going. How's that? And I mean, that's a very Henry McMaster thing.
And he did get to appoint his own running mate for the first time.
That's
we saw Pam Evett do that. So I want to transition into Jeffrey, keeping with inside the State House, but also we're going to talk about statewide. We're going to look at corruption, something that you've been following since, I guess, during your entire tenure here. But the past 10 years, we've seen 9 sheriffs have been convicted of crimes over the past decade. 3 sheriffs are awaiting trials. That's been one of the corruption scandals that we've seen ongoing in South Carolina. What's going on there? And can you give us a little summary about what that's about?
Yeah, the quick summary is South Carolina sheriffs have a lot of power. I mean, you know, they're probably the most powerful position in this state, you know, and so with power comes the opportunity for corruption. This all started in May 2010. E.J. Melvin, the sheriff then in Lee County, was selling drugs out of the back of his SUV, and he got busted because the FBI gave him a list of drug dealers they wanted to look into because they thought he was dirty. So he looks at this list of drug dealers and starts calling them on the phone, says, hey, the FBI is looking at you. Hey, the FBI is looking at you. So boom. And he's still in federal prison right now. He was sentenced to 17 years. I'm not going to go into the list of all of them, but you know, we've had sheriffs that have used inmate labor for their own personal use. We had, you know, a sheriff who was hiding people that were in the country illegally when they got arrested. He was making sure that the federal government didn't peek in and see that they were in the country illegally. He'd pull them out of the jail or pull them out of the system before they could do that. Mm. We've had, my favorite was the fellow that you would, your credit report. If you had, like, if you wanted to, you'd claim your credit card had been stolen. He'd write you a report saying it had been stolen, you know, fake report, so you could get that $10,000 or whatever erased off your credit. So it's been all sorts of fun things that have gone on here.
Yeah, not much reform when it comes in the way of sheriffs.
And that's the thing, you know, all this stuff, but there really hasn't been a reform. They've almost had to reform themselves. I mean, the sheriffs will tell you that they've paid attention. SLED, you know, the State Law Enforcement Division has been cracked down on them, and they've paid attention to that, the fact that they're being scrutinized pretty good, and kind of checked and regulated their own behavior, but some of them, not all of them. We got 12 of them that have been, law enforcement's been looking into them. But I mean, in the end, that's the funny thing. There hasn't been a lot of reform outside of that self-regulation.
And a little bit of higher office before we get into the State House probe. Kennard in 2012 resigned because of improper use of campaign cash, and that kind of set a lot of things in motion, too.
The 2010 lieutenant governor's race had a lot of unknowns because Andre Bauer was running for governor. So several people that voters didn't know. So it was very important that you got your name out quickly. Kennard had a supporter who took, and I forget the exact amount, but tens of thousands of dollars and gave them in smaller amounts to dozens of donors. So those dozens of donors took that, their little bits and so when we looked at the campaign finance report, like, oh, look at all these people donating to Kennard. In the end, it was one person who was bundling these donations. And so it's funny, that's how Kennard kind of built his name recognition and got his support for 2010. Then, you know, he had money left over in his campaign account. He bought tickets to the SEC championship game with it, bought clothes, bought like an Xbox or an iPod, some kind of gaming device. I mean, you know, so that you can't do that. So
Kennard, that's not what it's there for. It's not a slush fund.
Kennard pleads guilty and resigns, and it's one of those butterfly effects. So Glenn McConnell, who we would probably be talking about as one of the most powerful and important people at the State House today, over this decade, instead, he gets elevated to the lieutenant governor's position, and honorably, too. He could have, like, stepped aside. Yeah. Several other people have in the past. But no, he says, I'm going to do my duty. Then he goes off and is president of the College of Charleston. Mm-hmm. That then gets people to say, let's elect a lieutenant governor. That gets Henry McMaster in office. I mean, you know, it's all...
Yeah, it's all fun. It's together. Really fun to look at how this all yeah. spans. And then, yeah. Andy, I want to tag you in here about the Statehouse probe, obviously the biggest corruption situation that we faced in the past decade. And in probably a generation, looking at how it all started with Bobby Harrell getting tossed out of office for misusing campaign money, and then how that probe kind of just snowballed into a bigger deal with other lawmakers getting kicked out. Can you give us a little bit of a background on that, Andy?
Sure. I mean, after the Kennard situation, they started looking at other campaign finance, and the first one they looked at was the House Speaker, Bobby Harrell, and it ended up being this very long, it ended up being a years-long probe of other lawmakers. After Bobby pled guilty and resigned, SLED produced a report that said, based on our investigation, here's some other tax that maybe a prosecutor could take, and the state attorney general was supposed to start looking at it. What had happened was that because Bobby Harrell and Attorney General Alan Wilson were in such a fight with each other over the issue, Wilson went ahead and assigned the case to a different prosecutor. It was First Circuit Solicitor David Pasco. He said, fine, I'm going to hand it to somebody else. Pasco handled the Harrell case and then was supposed to go back to the Wilson's office. And all of a sudden, the case seemed to kind of get quiet. When were we going to look at these other things? Pasco, then at some point, Wilson then handed the case back to Pasco. And what we learned was that in the SLED report, which was not public but eventually leaked out, was that some of the people that were supposed to be looked at were folks tied to political consultants for Alan Wilson. So, you know, there was some thought that had Alan Wilson sort of slow walked something because these were his friends, these were his consultants. But at that point, Pasco then started going hard at the case, and he won guilty pleas from a former House Majority Leader, Jimmy Merrill. Mm-hmm. And then he went after the Quinns, who are by far the sort of the political, the Republican political dynasty kingmakers in South Carolina. Richard Quinn has run a consulting agency for many, many decades. He has been the consultant for Henry McMaster, Lindsey Graham, Alan Wilson. He was the consultant for a number of state lawmakers. He'd also worked on presidential campaigns. The list kind of goes on and on. And his son Rick was in the State House and himself a former Republican majority leader. But at the same time, they had also represented a number of businesses and state agencies in doing work in the State House. That included the University of South Carolina, the state's ports authority, the Blue Cross Blue Shield, Time Warner, AT&T. So you get the idea that you know, here's a guy who is sort of at the intersection of dealing with politicians and also dealing with businesses and state agencies that, of course, had business before some of his politicians. So Pasco really looked at that issue. And eventually, Rick Quinn pled guilty and agreed to resign to a charge. Also, at the time, rather than getting a guilty plea from Richard, Richard's firm agreed to pay a fine. But essentially, the cost of this was all the news, the publicity from it, pretty much has ended Richard's political consulting business at this point. And then eventually, we kind of got a surprise when another lawmaker, Senator John Corson, got caught up in this. He had been apparently basically funneling campaign money and then taking it back for himself. Over the years, John Corson was always considered sort of one of the more upright politicians that all of us knew, but he was a Quinn client and unfortunately got caught in this and had to resign as well. We've now also had a guilty verdict, the first case that went to trial with Jim Harrison, who was the longtime House Judiciary Chairman, who actually happened to actually work with Quinn. He actually worked at Quinn's firm during the previous decade. And there were some issues there, and he actually was sentenced to 18 months in jail. But right now, that is being appealed. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing. And then we still have one more case pending against one more lawmaker. Again, another one tied with the Quinns. We think that's kind of the end of the corruption probe. But it's been going on now since 2013. It certainly has changed the House a great deal, especially a little bit in the Senate as well. It certainly has changed the political landscape because Richard Quinn is no longer sort of has this plate of politicians and business and state agency clients that he used to have, and now they're spread all over the place. So
yeah,
it's certainly a different landscape.
And now Richard Quinn is also still indicted on 11 counts of perjury, too.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. And then more recently, I neglected to mention that. Yeah, Richard was indicted on perjury, and those charges are still pending.
So well.
You know, there was a very interesting case that kind of bridged bridges the ARD to the Statehouse probe. You know, Nikki Haley herself had her own little ethics probe. You know, they looked into the fundraising she did when she was a, you know, when she was a member of the House and she was working for the Lexington Medical Center. And the House Ethics Committee took that money, you know, looked into that case and decided, yes, like a grand jury, there was a reason to investigate it. And then at the same day, within like minutes, voted to reject it and say that they weren't going to do anything about it. So it's funny. And that kind of transitioned Nikki Haley into being a big, we need ethics reform, which, you know, was kind of an interesting stance to find.
And then, Andy, I want to keep with you talking about the 2010 Tea Party wave. We're going to transition out of Congress. So in 2010, we had four of the states. At the time, there were six congressmen. Four of them were freshman congressmen, something at the time that raised concerns about losing political clout in the delegation. But over the years, we saw South Carolinians in the delegation, of course, make a name for themselves, like Trey Gowdy, especially during the Benghazi hearings. Mick Mulvaney, who was a budget hawk, is now acting chief of staff for the president as of this taping. So I just want to talk to you, Andy, if you want to, if we can really kind of start with maybe looking at Tim Scott being elected to the House in 2010, the first black Republican the state had sent to Congress since Reconstruction, and how his path worked his way up to where he is, especially with Senator Jim DeMint, the former senator.
Sure. I mean, you know, Tim Scott's story is not too different than Nikki Haley's. Again, we're talking about a guy who 15 years ago was a county councilman. And, you know, he gets elected to Congress in the first district, which is the coastal district, Charleston, Hilton Head and such, part of that Tea Party wave. And then Jim DeMint decides to retire midterm to take over the Heritage Foundation. Mm-hmm. And Nikki Haley's faced with a choice, you know. Who's she going to put in the Senate seat? And here is, again, the first woman, the first minority governor. So she chooses the first, you know, African-American senator in South Carolina history. Tim Scott ends up being an important member of Congress because he is seen as sort of a bridge between trying to win over new voters, younger voters. Tim's, you know, fairly young, you know, to the party. And so it was a historic, you know, obviously one historic politician picking another.
Mm-hmm. Jim DeMint was like Senator Tea Party, apparently. That's what they nicknamed him back then. And he left in 2012, like you said, to go to the Heritage Foundation. And that's when we saw Tim Scott get appointed. What that kind of leads into is an opening for that first congressional district seat that Tim was occupying, which kind of gives someone an opportunity, I should say. And that someone is Mark Sanford. And Jeffrey, can you tell us about how Mark Sanford got his comeback there in 2013, that special election for that House seat?
Well, you know, Mark Sanford always finds a way to get back in. So at the start of 2010, I figured we were done. Everybody figured, you know, Mark Sanford's done. There's nothing to do. You know, he's
Appalachian Trail.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
so
Meg's going to yell at me for mispronunciation.
But Tim Scott gets elevated to the Senate seat. You know, Mark Sanford sees his seat open, the one that he won, you know, and so, you know, runs against, how many?
16
do you have
candidates.
Down there?
16
yeah, I can't
candidates.
Remember exactly how many
up,
it
yeah.
was. And you know, so there was nobody really, really that had anything approaching Sanford's name in that. So, you know, he won that primary fairly easily, defeated Stephen Colbert's sister in the general, in the special election for that seat. She was running as a Democrat, and off it went. I mean, you know, I guess I'll fast forward all the way to 2018, when in the Trump universe, in the Trump presidency, that, you know, Mark Sanford always spoke his mind, and, you know, he said things about Donald Trump. Yeah, that angered some people, and lo and behold, he ends up losing to Katie Arrington in the Republican
primary. With $1 million left in his campaign war chest.
And we all sit here and then, you know, that opens up another door because, you know, for the first time since I think it was 1984, a Democrat beat a Republican in a congressional seat in
Very
South
close.
Carolina.
Joe Cunningham won that
Not,
first district.
You know, a new Democrat. Because, I mean, Jim Clyburn beats a Republican all the time. This was a new Democrat that flipped a seat, essentially. And this is the first time since 1984, Joe Cunningham. And so, you know, we'll see what happens in 2020. That'll be an interesting race.
All eyes on that.
And 2020 is also a census year. When I'm going to be, you know, South Carolina added a congressional seat. We have seven now. Started out with six. In 2010, it was six. 2010 census gave us seven. There's the outside chance that there might be enough people to get an eighth congressional seat. I will say, though, you'll probably see a big emphasis on getting people registered and into the census in 2020, just in case South Carolina can squeeze that in, because guess what that seat's going to be? If they get that seat, it's going to be 7-1. It's going to be seven Republicans, one Democrat. unless Joe Cunningham can hold on in that first district. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, we saw that 7th congressional district get formed in the PD in 2012. The PD in the Grand Strand, and that's Tom Rice defeated 8 Republicans for that seat, and he's held it ever since. And I just want to add that we've gone back to having 2 Democrats in the delegation because John Spratt was in the delegation back in 2010 before the wave, and then also Republican Bob Inglis. Those are the guys who were placed in the 5th and the 4th district by Mulvaney and Trey Gowdy, who also are no longer up there. So we've got some more freshmen in the delegation, too.
I like to call South Carolina a 2 degrees of separation state. If you don't know somebody, you know somebody that knows somebody. And politics in South Carolina, who did John Spratt get beat by? Mick Mulvaney.
Yeah.
Wow, here he is again. Look at him pop back up. And it's funny how that all kind of ends up circling around. And, you know, I can't let a discussion of 2010 U.S. Senate, U.S. House politics go, Gavin, without saying, you say Alvin.
Oh,
I say Green. Yes.
Green. I didn't get to cover Green. The 2010 race.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was in Baton Rouge, everybody.
Hey, I was Andy, in Columbus. You say Alvin.
I say Green.
Yes. There we go.
But Andy, kind of keeping with Congress so we can wrap up really quick. Tell me about Lindsey Graham. He stayed off in 2014. He had 6 Tea Party challengers and wasn't even forced into a runoff. What's the Lindsey Graham of 2014 to the Lindsey Graham of 2019 right now? What did we see happen?
Well, the Lindsey Graham of 2014 was, you know, you were dealing with a Republican Party that was angry that Lindsey compromised with Democrats, that he was seen as a little too moderate for some Republicans. And so, again, he drew 6 challengers. I mean, none of them were heavy name recognition, heavily funded. So he was able to kind of beat them back. But it was a bit of a surprise for an incumbent like that and for someone who, again, who has been sort of kind of known for bringing things back to South Carolina. Then all of a sudden, Donald Trump comes in, and like Haley, he initially criticized Donald Trump. In fact, he was running for president and was very much needling Trump. He was needling Trump, and Trump needled back by sharing his cell phone number at an event in Hilton Head. After Trump got the nomination, Graham fell into line, and then Graham became one of the president's chief confidants, especially on foreign relations. Mm-hmm. And he's also become a defender of the president when it comes to his Supreme Court nominees. His very, very emotional defense of Judge Kavanaugh is going to go down as part of his political history. And I think what people have noticed is that all of a sudden the criticism that he was receiving from sort of the far right has kind of dissipated, and he's expected to have a fairly easy reelection bid next year.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy to use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier, the Associated Press, and the Richland Library. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on December 13th, 2019. Friday the 13th, see you later, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thank you for listening.
Secret message. Nos vemos mañana, Tecada.